Everybody know how to feel your heart? Yes? Some? The sensation that you can get without touching anything? I'm starting off quiet. Certain things you can't say too loudly. All right, so does everybody have a copy of this, what are we calling it, the conference reader? Yes?
Yeah.
All right, I've got slides on the back. There's like one page, page 48 and 49, that I'll be working from. So quick, just intro, myself, my name is Dan Kittredge. Most of you probably know me in some fashion. I grew up on an organic farm in Barrie, Mass, which is about an hour due east of here. This is my mother over here in the front row, the blonde. Everybody know Julie? A lot of people know Julie, yeah. So I think what I want to bring to this presentation this morning is as much common sense, practical farmer know-how as possible, and integrating all the insights and inspirations and things about biological systems. I think, can I talk about pests and diseases, Julie, or not? All right. I grew up on an organic farm where we worked a lot, there was always a healthy presence of a lot of pathogens. I think most people are probably familiar with that. Yes? Potato beetles, cabbage loopers, mildew, blight, that stuff. Don't know about that. Yeah. My job, basically, I was always farm manager. After college, you know, I'd come home and manage the farm and then go bumming around various parts of the world doing various things. Got me to a point when I was 27 when I got married and I didn't have any other marketable skill sets. So I realized that if I didn't want to work long, hard hours and make not much money for the rest of my life, I better figure out how to do a better job farming. It's been a part of my quest, I guess, in the past 6 or 7 years to really understand, to the best of my ability, biological systems and how to work with them in a collaborative fashion. How do we systemically address limiting factors and deficiencies in a way that lets life do the work? I feel like I'm, you know, doing decently well in relation to my competition. So I make more money farming than I do anything else. I've got various ventures people probably know before, but I find farming to be the most lucrative thing I do. So I just want to share with people, to some extent, the things that I do and the principles and why. You know, I have a larger context where I think that this work can be very systemically beneficial for environmental issues, political issues, economic issues, spiritual, you know, a lot of these sort of systemic things that are out of whack, I think can be systemically addressed through soil and food and health and all the ramifications of that. So we had a movie last night and a little conversation afterwards, and someone was surprised when I sort of acknowledge that, of course, we need a revolution. Apparently, it was a big deal to say that, sort of in an offhand fashion. Like, obviously, a revolution is necessary. Yes, I'll speak up. Again, certain things you don't want to say too loudly. Or not. Every 20 years, Thomas Jefferson said. I really think that through soil, we can facilitate the evolution, at least. We can discuss that perhaps today in the afternoon when there's going to be a little more time for question and answer and digression. Right now, I'd like to sort of focus on best practices walking through the growing season. And again, for people who just showed up late, page 48 and 49 of your conference reader. So soil testing, I think Derek did a good job of covering an immense amount of information yesterday afternoon in the last session. There was a discussion of Logan Labs, and a lot of people here are using the form. I've got some forms I printed out. Don't feel obliged to take one. But if you don't have one and want one, this is something you cannot get off the website. It's gives you the cobalt, molybdenum, selenium, along with everything else for $25, which is the best price I've been able to find anywhere. I don't have any kind of a fiscal relationship with them. I just think they do the best job for the best price. So you can't find that online. So keep a copy, photocopy it, and you can use it and pass it out to your friends if you'd like. So I like to say that the growing season starts in the fall. At the end of your, you know, crop year, whether it's your tomatoes or your peppers or your potatoes, kale, at the end of the year is when you have the opportunity to do the most systemic benefit to look forward. So I know we're late in that process, so I'm going to skip over some of the things we've already discussed. I think soil testing and mineral balancing is a great foundational thing to address systemic underlying deficiencies. I spent a little bit of time in the Himalayas and meditating in my early 20s, and I was all hot on energy and things like that, and I came to the conclusion that without grounding on the physical plane, a lot of the higher frequencies are going to be difficult to ground. So if that makes sense to anybody, perhaps it's a rationalization, but just from a very practical standpoint, John talked a lot about enzymes and the critical role of enzymes in basic biological systems. He said we need 60 different minerals for plant function to optimize. We need these minerals for our DNA to function well. There's lots of rationales why we need to look at a very broad spectrum of mineralogy. From the macros to the traces to the pico elements, et cetera. So I think from an economic standpoint, certainly it's very intelligent to be systemically proactive about building the mineral levels in your soil. You don't need to spend a lot of money. You don't need to buy things that are processed. You can use local materials. I strongly support the use of local stone dusts and seawater. I think between the two intelligently utilized, we need nothing else from off-site. Certainly there are many beneficial materials you can purchase. So just as a reminder, Derek made this point, soil testing is a snapshot. It's a point in time, it's a snapshot of a living system which is constantly morphing and modulating. You need to see it not as these are, you know, set in stone cardinal numbers, but this is a general ballpark of where you stand. And if you do it, every fall equinox you take a soil test, in 3 or 4 years you're going to have some serious perspective on where you have been and where you are. And no number is perfect unless all numbers are perfect, so don't get anal about, you know, the details and, you know, all the detailed math. It's a morphing, modulating living system when we're trying to generally get it back into tune. I was a music major in college, or accepted as a music major. I didn't complete the degree, but I think that music has some interesting metaphors for those who are so inclined. Anybody been to a elementary school band concert? Some people have been to an elementary school. I remember being in elementary school band concerts, actually. It's sweet and all, but sometimes it's a little dissonant. I think our soils are functionally dissonant. Mineralogically, they're out of balance. Biologically, they're out of balance. All of these things are, you know, every mineral is actually a vibration. Everybody's cool with that? Yes? John talked about the electromagnetic spectrum yesterday in passing. My understanding is that living systems communicate, both through receiving information and putting out information on a vibrational spectrum. There's some really good science and research on that for people who are interested. But from a functional perspective, our bodies, when we're missing, you know, the B flat from the flute of cobalt, you know, we're missing, the core is not complete. Or when I don't know what another metaphor is. We've got some heavy metals in there that are sort of like sharp or flat notes. It screws up the overall vibration and we don't get the overtones. That's in our bodies and our functional capacity, but it's also in our soil and foundationally in our soil. So understanding what's not there and working to get it back into tune from a systemic perspective, I think, is a really good idea. And generally operating on the scopes that we are, the amount of acres and the value of crop that we can get, there's not really many reasons why you shouldn't be doing that. Maybe if you've got forages, you've got 100 acres of grass, you can't do that quite so rapidly. But anybody who's doing vegetables or you know, crops, I think, that's not grains, is certainly can do that efficiently and intelligently. And Arden Anderson said this 4 or 5 years ago. I think he probably continues to say that. 90% of the analysis of a soil and the soil system is a history and a physical, is looking at the, you know, the symptoms of that soil. What are the exact details of how the management is operating? You know, the nuances of when the soil is dry, where it's wet, how compacted it is, how functioning the biological system is, where the organic matter is good. All those nuances and details are much more important, really, in actually systemically building a functioning system than the mineralogical profile. I really think if you start to do good management and take care of the basics in an intelligent fashion, you know, the amount of time and energy and money on the minerals is really a fairly minor component. It's certainly important, but really I want to focus on those management practices as much as I can. So I handed out the form. Hopefully people have passed it around. Didn't get stopped anywhere. Still moving. Okay. And so I've got here on the middle of page 48 my basic target mineral levels that I recommend to people, take it or leave it. We can talk about it later if you're curious. I don't need to go into it because Derek did a good job yesterday covering all those things. I do want to emphasize the local materials that people, I think, oftentimes overlook, specifically stone dust. For anybody who's local here in Mount Tom, you have a very, very valuable mineralogical, energetic resource for your land. I think John said yesterday that it was difficult to get crops up to stage three. Remember that? He said the first stages, stage one and two of basic functionality, you can do in a year or two, but getting to stage three is a more complicated project. I grew some arugula last year on land that was actually my first year cropping, although I've had for 2 or 3 years I've been putting minerals on it. And they were certainly stage three arugula. Or four. I planted them in the end of June, right before the drought. We got almost nothing for rain from the last week in June through the first week in August. I irrigate from a seasonal stream, which dried up. I had enough water to water the arugula a couple of times after I seeded it, but basically after that, it didn't get hardly any attention of any sort. I did do a good job putting it in. But that arugula grew vigorously through July, through August. I picked it between 5 and 6 times, depending on which parts of the bed you're talking about. There was no irrigation, I might have foliar sprayed it once or twice, probably not. No flea beetles, middle of the drought. It was, you know, plants, when given the foundation of a functioning system, can really do amazing things, and that's my experience. So 84 feet long bed, 4 foot wide, 250 pounds of arugula in the middle of a drought at $10 a pound. Do the math on 4 times 84 square feet times, you know, what percentage of that is an acre, and then I made $2,500 on that one bed. I had a market. No one else had arugula. you know, there's opportunities here for us to succeed in adverse conditions when a lot of people can't. And I suggest that while this is good from an environmental perspective, et cetera, from the farmer's perspective, what really matters, or a really important component, is that it's viable economically. And I certainly have great success economically. I think I did about $30,000 on a third of an acre this summer, and that was on about 15, 20 hours a week. Poor management, but certainly when the foundational pieces are in place, things really take care of themselves very nicely. So stone dusts, one of the things I had done in that bed was I had put down a lot of Mount Tom, you know. Mount Tom is a paramagnetic basalt with a broad-spectrum trace element quotient. I don't fully understand paramagnetism, although I hope to at some point. Although I think that has a significant aspect in the value. I basically used that was that, and I did limestone and gypsum and rock phosphate and that stuff too. You get it. Palmer Paving Company carries it. Lane and Sons owns the quarry, I believe. I got it from a guy named Tom Vanacore in Bridport, Vermont. He's, I think, Soil Builders LLC or Stone Local. What's the name of rockdustlocal.com? Rockdustlocal.com. Yes. Yep. They have some. It's the fines that out of the bag from their crusher dust. So it's like 350 mesh. It's ridiculous. It's flour, stone flour. It's $4 a ton. You get a dump truck load, and it costs you $500, and you can do a number of acres systemically. Those are the kind of local resources that I think we don't really understand, and so people don't talk about that much. Also, it's hard to make money on them, so people don't talk about them very much, but from a farmer's perspective, I think they're very valuable. So one of the things I did there that I think was why that arugula succeeded so well was I had intended to build a hoop house there, so I just gave it like all the love, when in doubt, give it some more. And I put, and $4 a ton, you can afford to do that. I usually say 10 tons to the acre. Although that stone flour, you can do it 2 to 3 tons to the acre and have a significant benefit. The finer the particle size, the less you need to get a benefit. So there are numerous deposits of local stone dusts around. I think it's a very valuable component for people to consider and look into. I find it very systemically beneficial. And that with seawater, which we can perhaps talk more about in detail later, are very valuable amendments to consider, along with the basic mineral balancing that your soil tests are going to recommend. Is that basically clear for people? Specific questions?
Yeah, with something like that, rock power.
Yeah.
Can you use it, say a planted cabbage on it, like grid?
Yeah.
You just drop it over the planting grid, instead of spreading it widely, get that rock up there.
You're up north in Vermont, and you got plenty of good deposits of good stuff up in Vermont. Tom's doing a good job, Rock Dust Local. He's doing a good job sourcing stuff. He makes a commission, I'd like all this information to be out in public about what deposits are where. I'm talking Vanacore. Tom. His info is on page 35. Thank you, Derek. I remember you seeing that in your handout. Okay, great. Anybody can go around and look at the local quarries. In general, basalt is best. Granite is next best. Anything from a gravel or a sand pit is least valuable, and I wouldn't recommend it. Okay. Compost, as far as systemic beneficial things to do from a fertility perspective, can be an extraordinarily valuable material. I really shouldn't be the one here talking about compost. There's, the two best compost makers that I know of in the top half of New England, at least, are, I think, in this room. So where's the other one? There's one, they're right next to each other, right there. All right. See those two over there? You guys want to raise your hands? Or you could even stand up. Anybody who wants to, know about compost, you have an amazing opportunity to pick brains over here. So neither of them wants to acknowledge themselves. I won't even bother using their names. Okay, fair enough. In general, from my perspective, a lot of people use compost, and compost can be a very valuable material, an extraordinarily valuable material. It can be, detrimental over time if you use a poor quality compost. The thing that I think is important about compost is that it have a balanced bacterial and fungal quotient. I think a lot of the poorer quality composts, along with not being well cured, are dominantly bacterial. And my understanding is that most of our crop plants require a much more fungal ecosystem to flourish than weeds. And so functionally, when your compost has more fungi in it, it's more of a crop feed than it is a weed feed. Many people oftentimes put down compost and have weeds jump out of the ground, and they say, I would say mistakenly, that's a sign of great fertility. If your weeds are flourishing and your carrots are being taken over, something's wrong with your fertility. Does everybody agree with me on that? Not yet. No. All right. Do people believe it's possible for you to broadcast carrot seed and, you know, let it sit for 6 weeks and not be taken over? Do you believe your carrots can actually germinate and grow fast enough to compete with weeds, if not outcompete your weeds? How many people say yes? Oh, well, I might as well say yes. That's the right answer, obviously. Ambivalent? No ambivalence? And no, the skeptics here in the field? Yes, all right. I had a really interesting experience with my arugula that I saved some arugula seed this year, and I planted it in, I think it was the beginning of September. It was the middle of September. And I was picking it in the end of October outside, and the arugula was four inches tall, and the pigweed was 1 inch tall. I know that's not carrots, but still, I was pretty impressed. No weeding, you know, just seed it and come back and pick it. And no weeding, it just sort of outcompeted them entirely. I thought that was pretty impressive. On principle, I think you're going to have a hard time doing that, getting your crop plants to outcompete your weeds, if you do not have a well-established biological ecosystem in the soil. And there's certain things you can do to, you know, put your finger on the lever one way or the other. And compost is a good way to put your finger on the lever one way or the other. So. Whether you're buying compost or making compost, there's the basic, you know, carbon to nitrogen ratio point. But the major point for me is the inclusion of woody materials, specifically Remyel wood chips. Ideally, are the best. Wood chips are branches less than 2 inches in diameter, less than 1 inch. What's that?
Like
brush. Brush. Anybody got brush on the edge of a field, growing in? Yeah, okay. So, right as, I don't know what your climates are, but sometime in the beginning of April, mid-April, when the buds are filling and about to burst on that brush on the edge of the field, when you probably still aren't totally overwhelmed with things to do because it's only beginning of April, hopefully, go cut that brush. Just at that moment, with all the, you know, growth hormones and minerals that have been, and sugars that have been saved in the roots all winter long, are up in the top, getting ready to burst. There's an amazing amount of really powerful biological compounds right there. You can harvest them. You want to cut that brush anyways. Schedule it. You know, the second week in April, we're going to cut the brush and get a chipper, borrow a chipper. You can also talk to road crews that come through in the summertime and cut, you know, branches. I found that a case of beer can be easily converted into 10 yards of wood chips. If you ever are... Or smile, a chicken, you know, a roast, whatever you've got in the freezer. A barter is always nice, depending on the, you know, character of the crew. You know, if they would have had to drive an hour to make the dump, and you're giving them a case of beer, and they can dump it right here, they get an hour at the end of work to have a couple beers, and they're very happy. They'll think about you next time they're around. And woody materials are great, I think. Not to digress too much, I also suggest that it's a great place to put inoculants, biological inoculants, you know, making sure you get the full spectrum of species that you want to have present in your soil. You know, a small amount of money spent on inoculants put into that compost pile guarantees their presence. Biodynamic preparations are awesome to put in compost piles, and you can also do a lot with your, say, stone flour and other minerals as well. Your minerals that are generally considered to be less bioavailable, whether it's limestone, which you don't want to put too much of on, rock phosphate, green sand, a lot of those general organic mineral fertilizers that have a nice broad spectrum mineral quotient, but they also have a macro in them, are great to put in a compost pile. Not too much, but generally they say that that your rock phosphate is worth twice as much after it's been composted than before it was composted from a biological perspective. The bacteria and fungi in the gut of the compost pile have digested that rock mineral and made it bioavailable. So systemically, a really good thing to do if you're doing, if you're making compost, I suggest.
Excuse me.
Yes. I would, the question is, what do I mean by not too much? I don't have enough experience to speak intelligently. I generally say moderation is a good policy. Anybody know about this dowsing thing? Kinesiology, muscle testing, accessing your intuition? Heard about it? Maybe even think it's a good idea? Anybody? I'm being sarcastic, come on. I generally suggest that when making decisions about this kind of stuff, that doing whatever you can to access some sort of intuitive understanding is a really good policy. So if dowsing works for you, douse. If muscle testing works for you, do that. If you have a relationship with the spirit of your land, the divas, the plants, the compost pile, anybody into Findhorn and all that stuff? Some people know him. I think, come on, really? I think there's a whole bunch more of us out here than we'd like to talk about. That's, to me, to my best knowledge, that's where the answer is. Generally, you're just, people cook here. Yes. How much of what do you put in the, about that much, right? It feels right. We do it unconsciously a lot. But if we're just a bit conscious of it, there's almost like you can feel it. You can almost feel the resistance. Radionics does the same thing. People know about radionics. Enough on compost. My understanding is that, and again, I defer all questions to these guys over here, if I'm wrong. If they think I'm wrong, I'm going to take their word for it. My understanding is that it is when you have lignified carbon, which is basically wood, that bacteria don't really break that down. It's the fungi that break that down. So if you've got a significant quotient of the carbon aspect of your compost pile is made out of woody materials, when that is fully composted, you know you've got fungi. Yes, Carl. Yes, that's a very good point. So a static pile is going to be much better than a turned pile. What you're saying is when you turn it, don't till it, but just take pieces and move them up and down. As opposed to most things, which don't benefit from being treated gently. I got one smile on that. I don't make compost. I haven't gotten around to it yet. I've only been on my farm for 4 years, and I've had other things to focus on. I'm putting together a nice bedded pack right now. That's Carl Hammer, the guy with the beard, and the one right in front of him is Mike Lombard. Please access them in the breaks. Yes. That's why I'm suggesting you talk to him during the breaks, because there's lots of important information that can be conveyed very quickly if you have the right environment. And I don't think right now is the best environment to pick their brains. I did. Basically, when you're turning your pile, don't till it. just take it and move chunks and stacks, because you've got the fungal hyphae that are establishing, and they're like a web. And when you take that pile and you shred it into little pieces when you're turning it, it's much more destructive for them. Correct, Carl? Is that effectively what you're saying? Not really. Yes. He's not even paying attention. Okay. Anyway, for those who use compost, as a piece of a management system, those are my basic recommendations. I'd like to move on to cover crops. I think cover crops are a very a valuable piece of management, and again, it's oftentimes considered to be basic. I think it can be done quite well, and can be quite beneficial for your overall biological system. One thing that is very clear that I think perhaps a lot of people are not yet doing is that when you do a multiple species cover crop planting, at least three different species, you get a lot of the benefits of a perennial permaculture system with the interplanting and the companion planting, even if you do a monocrop, you know, a functional monocrop management program. So you do a half acre of carrots, you do an acre of tomatoes as your management program. If when you do your cover crops, you put in, like, I've got some examples here, rye, vetch, and clover, or oats, field peas, and forage radishes, things like that, you know, at least three different crops interplanted, you get a very, very much more beneficial effect. The specifics, what I've got here written is, in areas where you're warm weather crops will be planted next year, you interplant crops that will overwinter and grow in as early as March or April or May. If you're planting in the end of May or beginning of June, so your warm weather crops, you can get a lot of growth, a lot of deep root reaching down into the subsoil, pulling things up, opening up the soil, a lot of rich biological vitality with all the sugars that are being manufactured in the leaves being injected down into the soil and stimulating a very large, active soil life community early in the spring. When you till those under or integrate those cover crops before planting, you're going to have a very nice environment for your warm weather crops to go into. I'm suggesting the solanaceous family, the cucurbit family, those kind of crops, corn. And but not to plant those crops where you're planning on having your early spring crops, your spinach and your peas and your onions, early brassicas, early root crops. Whatever you're going to be putting in early, I would suggest you do a winter killing mix. Again, a mix with a multiple speciation, but importantly, have them die off in the winter and be there, all the root systems on underground, their detritus on the soil, and ideally prepare that bed beforehand. I use permanent raised beds, functionally permanent. I've got a tractor mounted bed maker that I borrow from my mother, and a 4-foot tractor tiller that I borrow from my mother, and we live about 20 minutes away, so I take the truck over and pick them up when I need them. But the 4-foot bed maker makes a nice 4-foot bed with a 1-foot path, and I just have my field laid out like that. And once the beds and the paths are set, they don't move. The pathway is where the pathway is, the bed's where the bed is, and if the bed gets, you know, it sort of erodes down over a year, I'll come through with the bed maker and re-up the sides. But I'm not going to systemically till the overall soil. When I'm preparing a seed bed, I take the 4-foot tiller and I come through and I drop it down about an inch. And I integrate in whatever detritus I've got on the soil. If there's too much, I might come through with a rake and pull it into the pathway, but that's not oftentimes necessary. But if you can minimally till the soil before you plant, and you do the work to establish a nice, functioning, stable biological ecosystem in the soil, you really are setting yourself ahead. That's the kind of environment, I think, where you're going to have crops that outcompete weeds. That's the kind of environment where you're going to have a nice fungal ecosystem in the soil that's going to be giving those fungal metabolites off, which is going to give our tomatoes and other more developed crops the food they need to really flourish. Does that make sense to people? Basic, fairly basic common sense. I think people do, even just, you know, one harrowing, you know, harrowing, tilling, plowing, all those things. People, if you've got a tiller, and you don't need to go down 4 inches, don't go down 4 inches. Yeah? If you can do it, if you can do an inch or 2 inches deep, and that's the only thing you do is just hold the PTO, the three-point hitch, up a little bit higher, you can have a dramatic effect. You're, you know, I say tongue-in-cheek, every time you till, you commit genocide. You know, you got a problem with the Nazis killing off a bunch of people. Well, every time you go out there and till, I don't mean to be disrespectful, but, you know, you want to talk about destruction to life. Every time you're out there tilling, you are killing off, you know, uncounted quadrillions of organisms. Mass die-off is, you know, the effect of your action. And it's not only mass die-off, it also means that the overall vitality of your soil is much diminished. And I think that's something we can learn a lot from the permaculture people about, and the microbiologists, et cetera. Is there a question over here? Yeah. Yes, sorry.
So what about incorporating some of the minerals, like if you have kaolin, saffron, getting that deeper?
What about incorporating minerals? The question is specifically about soft rock phosphate. Reams always taught, I believe, that you should put your rock phosphate down first and your limestone down on top of it. Because as minerals sort of leach through the soil profile, phosphorus always moves to the top and limestone moves and calcium moves to the bottom. So if you put the calcium on top of the phosphorus, they're moving in opposite directions. And Reams said there's a real major energetic reaction that occurs after you do that. You should not plant anything for at least 2 weeks because you might burn the seeds. But if you can do it that way, you'll have some benefit. So we'll get there in a second. I guess we've gone from cover crops to tillage, and the next topic is mulching. I believe that you don't find much bare soil in nature except in desert where there's not much life. So I can intuit from that that nature does not like bare soil, period. And so it's a major import to keep the soil covered if and when possible. A side benefit of that for me is a very, very vigorous earthworm population and what feels to me like a nice amount of life in the soil. And those guys, you know, eat it up here, poop it out down there. They're moving things up and down. They're opening up the soil. There's a lot of activity that's going on. As long as I've got it integrated into the top inch or 2 inches, I feel comfortable. If I'm doing a good job managing the biological system, that it's going to go where it needs to go. People know about Paul Stamets. Paul Stamets, the world's largest organism. He's the guy that found it. The world's largest organism. Yes, big fungal mat. It's like 20 miles wide or something. Yeah, these minerals are frequencies. And what Paul Stamets did was he injected a radioactive isotope of some mineral into the forest floor and had sensors set up. I think, I'm not sure the distance, every 5 miles or something. And I don't know the distance. It was at least, you know, I mean, more than 10 miles, 20 miles or 50 miles away. He had sensors that picked up that specific radioactive isotope 20 miles away at that speed. After it was injected into the soil, it showed up 20 miles away. We say, you know, all matter is energy. Einstein said it a long time ago. We don't actually integrate that into our assumptions about the way the world works. But these minerals are frequencies, and they do move, especially when you've got a good fungal community. So I'm not saying that all the limestone you're going to put on the ground is going to go where it needs to go immediately. But in general, you know, working to manage the soil life so that it's as happy as possible, as much as possible, I trust that the minerals are going to go where they need to go. And I always keep my pathways moist. I think that when you talk about soil moisture, that means the soil needs to be moist. And if you have the pathway dry out and you do bare cultivation, that you basically are keeping, you're making a little desert in between each bed. And these plants really want to reach out and talk to each other. You know, the bigger the root system, the bigger the top growth. And if your soil is, you know, bone dry every 6 feet or every 5 feet or whatever the distance is, you're really dramatically inhibiting the potential of that soil. Yes, there was another question over here. Yes.
I have a question about when you're establishing a new yard.
Yes. you're turning in a hayfield or sod, I have no problem with tilling up the soil, with plowing. Do whatever you need to do to establish that environment. You are changing the environment, but understand that you're not going to have high functionality until you've got a functioning biological system. People seen Jerry Bonetti talk here, some people. He told some story about a guy who was managing barns, some rich person, I don't know who it was in England, that had, you know, racehorses. And on their farm, they grew these amazing colts, you know, that were always competing. And during World War II, they had to till the soil, or the government decided, you know, we're going to turn these paddocks into productive land for crops. And there was no champion colts from that field after they turned it back in for 12 years. That, you know, when you build that biological system with all the different plants and the whole functioning system, you have much better mineral spectrum, better compounds, better health, better vigor, better vitality in those things that are eating the plants that grow from that land. So when you do that, understand what you're doing. If you can turn under sod an inch, you know, if you can only till an inch deep and take out the sod, that's certainly better than plowing it up or tilling it and harrowing it or whatever. I think that, you know, coming up when the ground unfreezes, whether it is in March or April, and dries out, before the grass starts to grow, is the point in the year when the sod is the weakest. And if you can get in there, if you can find a day when it's dry and the grass has not grown much, you can come in there with a tiller and you can do pretty serious damage on permanent sod, as in taking it out, killing it, without doing a lot of damage to the soil ecosystem. So that would be really optimal. Yes? Sheet mulching is great. Go for it. Lots of people have success sheet mulching. Or black plastic will work too. People just bring cardboard and hay and compost and cover it up so there's no sunlight. That works fine also. It might not work for somebody who's turning under a 5-acre field. But for other different sizes, that's definitely a good idea. Yes? Broad forking in the John Jevons model of, yeah. I don't think broad forking is, I mean, what broad forking does is it opens up the subsoil, allows air and water to percolate down there, which is definitely a good thing. You know, the deeper the aerobic zone, the deeper the soil life, the deeper the root systems, you know, the more soil the root systems have to pull from to feed their bodies. So getting aeration down as deep as possible is very good. I don't know if I could speak intelligently to the effect on the fungi. As long as you leave the soil in decent chunks, you're not doing major damage, I think. But the more you crack it up, the more you rip it up, the more you break those. Think about it as fiber optic cables, right? You know, how do we get our internet and everything else? It's all connected on these lines, and you break the line, and the energy and information does not flow anymore until it's reconnected. They will reconnect themselves, and they'll get back to business. So that's functionally what you're doing. Anybody see Avatar? Remember when they would pray, they'd bow down and touch their head to the soil? There's a visual there where they would do it, they touch their forehead to the soil, and this like web of light would just ripple out into the environment. If you remember that vision or that picture or can see it in your mind, that's the fungal web. And that, when you've got that present and functioning, you have the underlying infrastructure for your plants to really flourish. All the minerals and all that kind of stuff, really valuable, but only when that biological system is functioning well, I think, do you really get healthy plants. So management has a lot to do with getting that. And there's certain things that we do that minimize it or enhance it. So tillage, I think I basically covered that. Mulching, did I basically cover that? Stockpile mulching materials late in summer and fall for next year. Okay, so my basic practice when I'm putting in crops, everything that I can. So all the, you know, all the solanaceous family, all the cucurbit family, kale, collards, chard, broccoli, anything that's big. Things that I have in rows, like carrots and beets, I don't mulch. Mesclun mix, lettuce, obviously, don't mulch. Onions, I mulch. But from my perspective, if I can get into the onto the ground a nice cover of mulch, and by nice I mean like 4 to 6 inches deep, nice thick mulch, as soon as I put my plants into the ground, that is just, you know, it just really, really does a lot of benefit for the entire year. So I strongly support that. Whether you're making mulch, whether you're, you know, harvesting your cover crop, your, you know, oats or your rye and baling it and spreading it out like farmers do in big systems, leaves work fine. Kelp is great. I use mulch hay. I just keep my eye out, my ear to the ground. During the summer when people are out making hay, and you know there's always a storm that comes through and someone wasn't watching, if you pay attention to where the hay's down and what got rained on, and you know come by and offer a buck a bale out of the field or $2 a bale, you can stockpile a lot of mulch. Yes. Everybody asks me about that. Weed seeds. Doesn't that import weed seeds into your soil? For someone who has a very clean soil with no weeds, you know, don't let me tell you to import seeds. I have never really bothered to do anything like steel seed bedding or anything like that. So I figure I've got a weed population anyways, and if I can cover the soil deeply, I put my tomatoes in, I put my drip tape down, and I mulch, and I'm done. And that applies for kale, for collards, for chard, for, you know, cucumbers, summer squash, winter squash, eggplants, peppers, basil. You know, I mean, you can go a long way on most crops. Put them in, you know, get your basic capacity to irrigate in place, mulch them. And you really, you know, if you do a good job mulching, there is no weeding because there's no sunlight that comes close to touching the soil. There's no germination. They can't outcompete, you know, and your crops are in a good place because you've got good biological functionality. They're going to grow up and they're going to build a canopy rapidly. I think, you know, on any kind of a reasonable size operation, I'm at Derek's 4 acres, I would probably do, you know, if you're doing 10 or 20 acres, it's probably, you need to be mechanized about it. But you can certainly do that on significant acreage. The more the soil is covered, the better. You know, if you had green manures in the pathways, that would probably be better than mulching. But keeping the soil covered in some fashion, I think, is really important. All these basic things I'm trying to lay out here, we talk about the minerals and the biology and all the fancy stuff. I think that these basic management practices, if intelligently integrated, create the environment where the biology flourishes. Is that clear? Am I being too pushy about that? No, I hope not. When we get a wet spell, do I have a problem with too much wet material around my plants? I don't think so. You mean like disease and stuff like that? I should give you guys my shtick on disease. In 3 minutes or less, 2009, the year of the blight. The first year of the blight, the tomato blight, late blight. There was a whole bunch of hullabaloo going around. People were saying pull them up and burn them and bury them and all that stuff. And some people were getting hit and taken out, and other people were hardly getting touched at all. I got blight in October, mid-October. I had built a hoop house. It was my first year on our farm. I hadn't covered it yet. I planted the tomatoes in there, never got around to covering them. Middle of October, getting cold at night, I got blight. They all died. I pulled them out and put them on the inside wall of the hoop house. Planted my salad greens, grew them through the winter, came through, you know, whatever, middle of May, and put tomatoes back in that hoop house. Right, kept the blighted plants, the dead blighted plants, and then didn't water them, and waited for them to get infested. My objective was to inoculate my tomatoes with late blight because I'm of the opinion that there's no reason to be afraid of disease or pests. I'm not sure how long it took, two and a half weeks, till about 10% of the tomatoes were dead, and another 30% were having their arms fall off. At which point I watered them and fed them and applied some essential oils. In 10 days, the blight was gone. That was just my little you know, verifying for myself what I've been saying to other people, which was we don't need to be afraid. This seemed to be something people were afraid of. So I'm not afraid of disease and pests. I see pests and diseases as signs of as John said yesterday, pre-disease. If you're susceptible, that's not acceptable, right? If I'm going to be feeding this food to my children, I want healthy food. I don't want pre-diseased food. And so my opinion is that if we do these basic management practices, which we're laying out here today, and hopefully by the end of the day, you're going to have lots of details you can take home and apply. If you do those things, that pest and disease is no longer a concern. Your bigger concerns are how much space is the appropriate amount of space to give my tomato plant. If I'm going to have a tomato plant that's vigorous and vital, putting them at 2-foot spacing is no longer a good idea. Like 3, 4, 5 foot spacing is much more appropriate. You know, kale, cabbage, like a good 3 feet per, you know, right? I mean, healthy plants get big and they need space. If you want your, you know, peppers to be bushes, you need to give them more space. So you have a whole different set of considerations and then actually opportunities for more interplanting and companion planting in permaculture style opportunities. But yeah, I'm not concerned. That was 3 minutes or less. I do see, if there's anything that I see during wet periods is slugs. I basically just let them be. I've been told that Sluggo works really well. I think that's organic, certified organic. Beer is supposed to work, diatomaceous earth, ashes work, wood ash. I just let them be, but I'm a lazy farmer. So, yes, Linda. I'm not sure if they're insects. I don't think they're insects. I'm not sure. The question is where do slugs fit in that, you know, stage of plant resistance chart that John was laying out? I don't know. That's a good question for John. That's a really good question for John. I don't know where they fit. All right. That was mulching.
I just want to say something else about slugs. I have mulched forever, and I used to have slugs, and I don't really anymore, but I think once you attract frogs and snakes and all the other people in there that are going to eat things like slugs, you have a really, you know, diverse system that you're not going to have a slug problem. And I think it also has to do with better fertility and higher organic matter. I don't think they don't seem to appear.
Did everybody hear that? She said that she used to have a lot of slugs and doesn't have much anymore and thinks that when you create an environment where you've got snakes and frogs and toads and people like that that eat slugs, that may be part of why she doesn't have so many, or maybe in high organic matter. They certainly show up. They're certainly there. If I've got a pest that's the biggest pest on my crops, it's slugs, and they happen when it's wet. But not enough for me to want to do anything about it. So,
What essential oils do you use to mitigate that late blight?
Essential oils to mitigate late blight. I used Jerry Bernetti. People know about Jerry Bernetti. His company is called Agri Dynamics. Agri Dynamics. Do you have that one in, Derek? Agridynamics.com. He's got one for diseases that's called Mycostat. And one for pests that's called Escent Shield. So I didn't make the recipe, I just bought from Jerry. That's what they're called. Mycostat is for diseases, fungal, bacterial. Escent Shield is for insects. A foliar spray onto the leaf, you know, 2% solution, ideally not in direct sunlight. Okay, it's hay, straw, leaves, kelp, mow and bale cover crops before seeding for a mulch source. Maintain soil cover as a priority to feed soil life, maintain hydration and prevent weeds. Combine plastic mulch with organic systems, with organic materials and pathways if you use that system. If you use plastic mulch, John said plastic mulch is better than bare soil yesterday. Everybody heard him? If you've got a 2 or 3 foot pathway or a 5 foot pathway in between your black mulched beds, mulch that. Or plant clover or something living. But don't let that soil stay bare. It's really bad. Can I say something about plastic mulch? I have almost zero experience with plastic mulch. I don't use it. My operation's not that big. I like hay over everything. If I could get kelp, I'd use that. But I'd rather use something that's living, it's an organic material. You know, when it's hay, when it's gone from the green stage to more the stemmy stage, it's got more cellulose, it's more of a fungal feed, as John was talking about before, that facilitates that humification. My soil is shades darker than it was 4 years ago. It was a very light orangish soil, and it's dramatically darker. I think, you know, really keeping it covered and alive and sufficiently fed with organic matter really facilitates that humification process. Yep. If I'm putting down 4 to 6 inches of mulch, I'm putting it down when I'm putting my tomatoes in, or my peppers, or my eggplants, or my cucumbers, or squash, or kale, or collards, which I'm not going. They're going to be there all year long. The problem with putting down 4 to 6 inches of mulch is that 6 weeks later you need to put more down because it's all gone. People say that they'd have. You've heard about this? Like, people say that if you put. I don't know how this works. You put 4 inches of organic matter on the soil, and it's still there a year later. That's a bad sign, right? That means that's your biological test telling you your soil's not functioning. That means you need to cover crop, you need to till less, you need to maintain hydration. My experience with mulch is that if anything, I don't reapply soon enough, and my soils are more bare than I'd like them to be in the fall. For me, that's a major fertility amendment. Mulch is a really important priority, and I certainly scope everything out during the growing season for next year, and I stockpile it. I built a big, you know, lean-to on the back of my barn, and I just stuffed it full of hay, and you feel rich. I mean, when you got a big pile of mulch hay, it's just like, you know, it's like a big woodshed full of wood. It's just like, okay, we're in good shape. I really, really think it's valuable to keep the soil covered. Yes. So the question is wood chips. I would not recommend wood chips in the garden, in the pathways. I would not recommend that. If you're going to be putting down fruit trees next year or 2 years from now, you know, laying down wood chips where you're going to plant your fruit trees is a good idea. But the problem with wood chips is they are high in carbon and low in nitrogen. And so when you put them in your garden soil, they will functionally pull nitrogen out of the soil to break down, which functionally steals nitrogen from your crops, which slows their growth. So I do not recommend that.
Well, I actually think wood chip is one of the least useful nouns in English because it doesn't really tell you what it is. We could be talking old wood from pine tree. Mm-hmm. We could be talking about the apical tip of that same pine tree.
Very good point. So basically, did everybody hear that? The smaller the brush, the closer you get to the tip of the plant, to the edge of the plant, the more balanced the carbon nitrogen ratio is, and the less you need to be worrying about it. So functionally, at 10 to 1, 12 to 1. In short, if you're going to be mulching your garden with wood chips, get brush tips. And don't use sawdust or big wood chips from the heartwood of the plant. Is that fair enough?
And it's hard to generalize.
Which is why I say don't use wood chips.
Because
they can be good, they can be bad, but generally it's not going to be as good as you want them to be. Yeah. Linda? I would not put them in pathways. I would not put wood chips in the garden. Theoretically, yes. If you had Ramiel wood chips, you know, there's an argument to be made for why you should do it. In general, I say in general, don't put more than 20 pounds of manganese sulfate on per acre per year, period. Like, there's basic, safe rules of thumb, and then once you understand what you're doing, you know how to break the rules. And so if you want a safe rule of thumb, don't use wood chips in the garden. If you know what you're doing, you know, you feel free to experiment and do what feels right to you. Yes? So Catherine's saying she does it and has no problems with any nitrogen deficiency. Don't freak. If you know what you're doing, you've got a perennial system, you've got a well-functioning biological system. In a well-functioning biological system, all the nitrogen comes from the air, right? Everybody agree with me on that one? You do not need to add nitrogen to your soil. In nature, for a long time, no one added nitrogen fertilizer and plants grew fine, not just the legumes. Yes? In nature. So that means in nature, also by the way, we all know that 68% of the atmosphere is nitrogen. Right? Two-thirds of every breath of air you take is nitrogen. There are tons of nitrogen above every acre on the planet. There's plenty in the environment. When you have a well-functioning biological system, when you have the critical species in place and you've got the critical minerals necessary to build the enzymes that are used by those species to fix the nitrogen and feed the plants, when you've got the biology functioning and the minerals in place, your nitrogen is, you know, fixed from the atmosphere and you need not add any. And in that situation, certainly a lot of things that we consider to be breaking the rules are possible. All the rules have already been broken, right? But sometimes it's safe to have some guidelines to stay within until you get a little more experience.
If you have access to seed,
yes,
you use that to mulch your garden year after year. Do you have a problem with that salt?
If you use seaweed as a mulch on your garden year after year, will you have a salt buildup? It's entirely possible you'll have a salt buildup. Some people wash their seaweed. I don't have access to it. I've only used it a couple times in my life. But I would certainly be anything to excess is bad. Yes? Too much compost is bad. Too much liming is bad. Too much, you know, copper is bad. What's that? Too much hay mulch is bad. Yes, I'm not gonna go there. Okay, what if you had wooden sides to your bed? Here's my stick figure plant. As above, so below. In fact, preferably more below than above. John talked about the hormone balances last time, yesterday. He made some reference to it. You always want to have your bottom be bigger than your top. You know, any kind of healthy sized plant is going to be nice and broad. You know, a cabbage, you know, a broccoli, eggplant, whatever it is. And whatever you see as far as growth above ground, if that plant was healthy, there would be more below ground. So for me, the fact that you've got a little wooden edge to the bed is psychological for us, but has very little relevance to the plant. The plant expects to be able to reach out to the, you know, periphery quite some ways. And the bigger the plant, the farther it can reach out. When I mineralize my field, I do everything. I don't just do the bed and not the pathway for people who have gardens. In fact, I suggest you do a good 10 to 20 foot buffer around the edge of the garden, because if you've got sufficient manganese here and insufficient manganese there, you're going to have manganese from here, moving there. I find it really evident when I'm growing greens that the edge of the field where I haven't mineralized is where I see yellowing start. You know, the whole middle of the field is totally rich and vibrant, and over on the edge where I haven't mineralized, you know, I've just done the garden and I haven't done the pathway, is where my yellowing starts first. It's a field, it's an energy field. It's an energy field. Remember those, ever seen those pictures of the, you know, the a gravitational field? It's like a warp in space-time. You know what I'm talking about? Some people have me. Some people think I'm off the deep end. I can't draw that out. Anyway, if you've got a high level of energy in the middle and a low level energy at the periphery, and that energy is manganese frequency or copper frequency, you're going to have it draining out to the outside. So I recommend you apply your fertility amendments a good 10 or 20 feet outside of the edge of your field to build up that buffer area. That's a minor aside. Okay, enough on mulching. One more question. I've heard and seen good things, but I don't have any personal experience with Hugel culture. Hugel culture, H-U-G-E-L-K-U-L-T-U-R. There's various spellings. It's a permaculture practice where you bury wood and build these berms and things like that. There's a really good book out there, Sepp Holzer's Permaculture. Anybody want to sort of live in fantasy land for a little while? Sepp Holzer, H-O-L-T-Z, Holzer. Sepp Holzer's Permaculture, published by Chelsea Green, very interesting. He talks about Hugel culture. And he does amazing things on the side of a mountain, really amazing things. I think a lot of us in New England, maybe, I'm not sure how people are landowners here, but if you are and you have 5 acres or 50 acres, generally, you know, 80% of that is rock and, you know, swamp and, you know, hillside that is not usable land. And if you think a little bit creatively, and this is a great model, this book, Sepp Holzer's Permaculture, to just to get a vision of how you can be highly productive in the ecosystem we have. You don't just need to use flat arable fields. You can really use all of our land or a lot more of it very productively. And Hugel culture would be a good tool to use in that perspective. I would not put wood chips in my garden. Period. Just as a basic recommendation, they come into the garden in the form of compost. If you've got wood chips, if you've got a bedded pack, if you've got animals, you know, if you, you know, have access to them, break them down, let them compost. From my perspective, you know, better safe than sorry. You know, do a bunch of things well before you start to play around. That makes sense? Everybody basically understands that? Okay, enough on mulching. Water. Water critical at all times for biological systems. Certainly there are examples of where highly functioning biological systems can grow well through a drought. John gave us a very nice example of Marietta Pickett's farm. Did you catch the name of her farm? BEH, anybody? Bioenergetic Harmonics. They've been doing that for 30 years, running this place called Bioenergetic Harmonics. So he was able to get 100 and whatever it was, 70 bushels per acre of blue corn in the middle of a drought on that land after 1 year. But it was really, they had done a bunch of foundational work in the background on a bunch of different levels to make that happen, to give them that kind of result in the drought. So in general, I suggest, I believe Carrie Reams is quoted as saying, if you cannot maintain hydration, don't waste your money on minerals. Everybody get that? If you cannot maintain hydration, don't waste your money on minerals. First order of priority is maintaining that there's sufficient water in the soil for the basic biological processes to occur. When you have the soil dry out, the bacteria go into spore form. You know, the fungi shut down. Only in a really well-functioning system is your plant able to grow and be healthy when the soil is bone dry. I really think as the climate continues to get more erratic, that we should expect droughts and floods every year. And if you have a particularly well-drained piece of land, then don't worry about the floods. But in general, I think droughts are very likely, and it's not worth, you know, just playing the odds. It doesn't cost that much to get an irrigation system that's functional. And if you can't do 5 acres, do one. Or do two. Do a small amount well, and with less time and energy invested, doing a better job on a small amount of space, you can be much more productive and lucrative. But putting in an irrigation system or having the capacity to maintain hydration simply, I think, is very important. And as I said before, the area between the beds is part of the soil from the perspective of the plant. And when you, if you think that this plant is all living right here next to your emitter, you're missing the picture. The roots want to go out and reach out and have access to nutrition through the entire, you know, entire spectrum of the soil. So figuring out a way to, if that means putting in two lines of drip per bed and putting them towards the edge of the bed, so you have more of a dispersion, so be it. Put in two rows of drip. I think that'd be much more beneficial than putting one row right down the middle. If you don't do anything else, do that. So if you've got a grassy pathway, as it gets dry, they get water also. I would, if I could choose bare soil or something growing in the middle of a drought, I would vastly prefer something growing than dry. The bare. So what he's saying is if the pathway gets dry during the summer, it shuts down, the biological vitality shuts down. That's why I'm saying you should keep the pathways wet. I don't see any reason why you don't keep the soil wet, as moist, as much as possible everywhere, where your plant roots can reach. In my case, I've got a 4-foot bed and a 1-foot pathway. So if I put two lines of drip on the outside of the bed, you know, there's a 2.5 feet each way they're reaching. But as a concept, the principle is the soil is where the life, you know, is based, and wherever the soil dries out, the life shuts down, and that inhibits the function of the plant. Does that make basic sense? Yeah, so that's why bare cultivation is bad of your pathways. You know, if you've got a 3 or 4 foot section or a tractor path in between each bed and that's bare cultivated, you've got a desert with a little wet strip and a desert with a little wet strip. Does that make sense? That's not going to be beneficial for soil life. If you don't keep the soil moist, the soil life does not flourish, the plant does not flourish. All the foliar sprays, all the drenches, all the minerals, all the inoculants are not going to help if you don't have moisture in the soil. I think I'm clear. Prefer clover than hay mulch. I think both would be great. Yeah, whatever works better for you. I don't want to see it bare, and I'd like to see it moist. Okay. If you have to choose either irrigation or mineral nutrition, irrigation is more important. Drip tape, overhead sprinkler, hoses. Anybody who's not ever experienced drip tape or doesn't know what drip tape is, look it up. You know, spend a little bit of time doing some homework. For $50 or $100 in any kind of a backyard scale, you can get a full-on system. You know, I think it's, what is it, $100 for 7,000 feet of drip tape? Something like that. There's sources all over the place. There's tons of them. Yep. Yep. I
has many advantages to shore water, but irrigation, lay out the grid so you can have 100% created tillage areas. Rural irrigation has no plastic, moves on gravity.
Yep. I've had, so what he's saying there basically is if you've got, if you can get, in a, like ideally in a permaculture system, you've got water up high. People know about that. You want to get your water and get it high and then have, you can have gravity feeding down the rest of your property. So if you've got a water source above your field and you can, you know, have a basically a, you know, minor irrigation canals where you can open it up and it'll run down the beds or down the pathways and keep the soil moist that way by soaking the soil, he's suggesting that's a good idea. I've tried that at various points in time and I like it. I like how it works. I find if I've got my pathways are on a one, two, three degree incline going down the side, then I can let water come in across the top and just with a hoe, just, you know, when this pathway has had enough, close it off, let it come down to the next pathway, and you can really do a nice job there. It certainly is how people have irrigated in the past for many, many years. For a lot of people, drip tape is going to be a much simpler system to set up, but there are also really good sort of permaculture type solutions out there. Okay, enough on water? Yes? Could I talk about water quality? I'd love to be able to talk really well about water quality. It's a very important point. Thank you for bringing it up. Water, is John here yet? He just walked in. John, right on time. Would you like to talk about water quality and energetics? Yes, he would. This is my plan to ask him leading questions throughout the morning. Conspiracy of one.
Conspiracy of one. So, on the topic of water quality, there's obviously a lot of water quality problems that we work with. A lot of different farms. The biggest concern, single biggest concerns about water quality is water hardness, bicarbonates. And the concern with bicarbonates, when you do a water analysis and you typically, when water has an alkali pH, you will have both calcium and frequently highest levels of calcium, occasionally also potassium or magnesium bicarbonates. The challenge is simply that those bicarbonates that are in water complex and bind nutrients and prevent them from being absorbed by plants. And they do so very, very efficiently. They don't release them very well. And the bicarbonates typically also do not leach through the soil system very readily. So to buffer those out, to take those out of the system, the very best tool that we have to work with today is using our humicarb, which is a fully formed humic substance at about 10 parts per million in the water system. We'll tie up those bicarbonates and prevent them from complexing your nutrients.
So for those people who like to understand the principle of what that is, you take a bag of powdered humates or finely ground humates and mix with water and use that to buffer out the bicarbonates. Is that simple enough, John? Yeah, okay. I don't know what the percent concentration is going to be because I don't know what the concentration is on his stuff. Probably have to be doing it significantly more concentrate because his stuff is pretty dense. The issue with water, John, from my perspective, is photonic emissions and things like that. Not going to talk about it? Okay. Anybody ever looked at water flow in nature? Down a river, down a hillside, look at the way rivers are shaped. Water never flows in a straight line in nature. Water actually, to my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, anybody who knows better, water flows in a spiral. It spins. And when you see the rivulet going down the hillside, that's sort of a two-dimensional plane, but really it's going like this. And it likes to have spin and torque. When we put water through pipes and through hoses and long straight lines, it loses a lot of its vitality, its vigor, its energy. People have talked about how you can keep a crop alive with irrigation water, but the plants don't grow until it rains. Anybody ever had that experience? There's something about water in its natural environment where it's got that, there's something about the energy of it. I wish I could speak more intelligently to this topic. Let me get a different mic. Victor Schauberger is probably one of the best people to look into if you want to know more about this. Victor Schauberger. Water that's stagnant, so from a stagnant pond that's warmed up, it's going to lose a lot of its energy. What is it, 38 degrees, John?
39 degrees.
39 degrees seems to be the temperature at which it has the most vitality. Was it Schauberger? How's the story go? He was Victor Schauberger, really interesting fellow. He was an Austrian forester, I believe. I spent a lot of time hanging out in the woods. He was sitting looking at the waterfall. Here we are in Germany, about mid-1800s, late-1800s. And he's watching the fish spawning and jumping, you know, 30 feet up the waterfall to go to their spawning ground. Ever think about how they do that? Like how a fish jumps so high logistically? I mean, they do it all the time, and so it's obviously doable, but, you know, can we actually understand the physics of how that's possible? The understanding I have is that, you know, they were basically getting this whole, they were, you know, they spin around and build up energy, and there's a real subtle energy aspect to this whole process. But to make a long story short, basically, water that's flowing naturally and is cool has a lot more energy. And when you put water through pipes, it sits and stagnates and is hot. If you got a, you know, water catchment system off of a roof and it's, you know, 70 degree water, it has a lot less vigor and vitality and energy than natural water. So there are tools out there in the market you can use to energize water. If you've got it coming through a, you know, a town water system or a hose or a, you know, 400 deep foot deep well, there's things you can do to energize it. But that's an interesting piece of the puzzle I would like to at least stick in your head. Yes?
If you ever caught a fish in the fall as opposed to the middle of the summer, you can tell the vigor of the fish.
You can tell the vigor of the fish from the temperature of the water. Yeah. There's all this common sense out there, knowledge that somehow hasn't ever made it into the science books. Anyway.
Okay.
Yes? Chlorinated water. What do you use chlorinated water for? I mean, why do they chlorinate the water?
I have a chlorinator.
To kill things, yes. My understanding is that the energy signature of that chlorine is still in the water, even if the actual chlorine is not there anymore. That from a homeopathic standpoint, you have dosed the water and it still is containing that energetic signature. So, yeah. Ideally, you want water from a natural setting that's flowing, or, you know, people who have land, you know, we can do this. We can look at the land and find places where water can be, you know, worked with. It's an issue. I would look up, you know, water structuring devices, you know, spend a couple $100, buy something, you know, or $50, play around with it, water this bed, not this bed when you're transplanting with this thing, and see if you see differences. Water is a really interesting topic. Having it is critical. Having it energized can be really profound, can be really, really dramatically profound, and you can get a lot done with just that and nothing else. Okay, seed. Seed is a topic, John referred to it a couple of times yesterday. When I give my course, I tell people there's a lot of problems out there, and most of them have fairly readily available solutions, and seed is one of those ones I don't think has a readily available solution for it. There's no place I can say go buy and you can know you have, you know, best quality. I've been calling a lot of the sort of elders in the seed movement industry in the past month and trying to pick their brains and trying to find solutions to this issue. The basic issue is that what we get is basically the bottom of the barrel in most cases as far as quality. What's available to us in the marketplace, sometimes it's mediocre, occasionally it's good, in many cases it's quite weak. And that has everything to do with the environmental conditions that the mother plants have experienced in the previous generations. If you understand epigenetics, you understand that the environmental conditions that the previous generations experienced have a dramatic effect on the vitality of the next generation. And from talking to, you know, all the who's who in the organic seed movement, you know, companies and players, there is not a lot of people out there actually paying attention to this level of sophistication in nutrition in the seed plants. I know John has worked with seed growers in the past and had some pretty impressive results. The story I remember you telling me about the tomato grower who was on your program got fired from his contract because the seeds are too big and they couldn't make enough money. Is that the, basically how it went? That, you know, he said, you know, he got the bug and said, oh, well, I can do a better job growing better quality seed, and did a really good job on nutrition. His seeds all got dramatically bigger, and his buyer no longer bought from him because they make money on unit seeds, and the bigger the seeds, the less money they make, right? Make sense? In some kind of conventional fashion. I would suggest that I would be happy to pay a premium. I'd be very happy to pay a premium for high quality seeds. As an example, I was talking to Johnny's, and one of the guys there said, when we get our Bolero carrot seed in, sometimes it's 200,000 seeds per pound, and sometimes it's 800,000 seeds per pound. That's Bolero. That's not like Bolero and Scarlet Nantes. That's just Bolero. There's no difference there except for the environmental conditions that the mother plants were in and the effect that had on their seed vigor and vitality. I'm making an assumption here that you agree with me that seed size is important. John referred to that a little bit yesterday with his corn example with 62.8 pounds per bushel, which is dramatic. That's remarkable. That's if you go out to the Midwest and you say, I got 62.8 pound corn, they'll think you had too many beers and you're just, you know, boasting. It's not, people don't do that. What's that? 150% of average. I mean, dramatically larger. And what happens when you have those minerals in there and the nutrition in there is that you have the germ and the vigor and the vitality of a healthy, you know, a healthy newborn, a really healthy newborn that can get up and go. People have cows, you know, you get some calves that are just, you know, have it and some are weak. Babies, you know, all babies of all sorts, plants and animals, you know, some, you know, came from a really rich environment and are vigorous and vital to start off with, and some are really quite weak. Doesn't mean you can't work with all of them, but it means that your starting point is dramatically different. So sourcing high quality seed is, I think, a way that we can really dramatically improve our results with no other effort. Simply by getting high quality seed, you're going to get a dramatic effect in your overall functionality. Yes. If you save your own seed, what the industry uses is screens. They literally use different size screens, and they have gravity beds, but a different size screens will work. Yes, visually is fine. If you get a packet of tomato seeds, lay them out on the table, and see which ones are flat and which ones are fat. You know what a flat seed looks like? Chuck them. You know, if you plant that flat seed and it ends up germinating, it's going to be weak and slow for its entire life. And you're going to give it time and space, and it's never going to produce for you. So all the way along, if you've got various ways of looking at it, if you're a small enough operator, you can look at them, that pick them out, that's great. What you can do is you can call the company and you can ask them. That's what I generally recommend people do. And I've, you know, I've talked to Fedco, I've talked to Johnny's, I've talked to, you know, they're all like, yeah, well, you know, if enough people start calling and saying things, we will certainly pay attention. C.R. Lawn, anybody know C.R. Lawn? Founder of Fedco, old hand, been around for a while. He said, you know, if I get three comments on one topic, on one variety, you know, stop the presses, something's going on. If three people write to me and say something, he knows something's going on. So literally, this is where your democratic power is real, is, you know, in a polite fashion, in a gentle fashion, say you're interested in larger test weight, you know, a higher quality, higher vigor seeds, And they're fairly defensive in many cases, but if you, you know, bring it out, so just putting that out there, what you can do is you can say, okay, I want to buy Bolero seed. Here's my Johnny's catalog. Here's my Haimoan catalog. Here's my Fedco catalog. You lay out your 20 varieties of seed you want to get. You call them all, and you ask them what the test weights are for this lot, and say thank you, and hang up, and call the next company, and do it, and choose by, you know, lot which company you're going to buy from. That is the best way for you to use your money, because they get different lots and they come in different sizes, and you start to make it really obvious to them that they're going to spend a lot of staff time answering these questions, and so why don't they just make that information public, so those of us who want to see can go download it on their website. That they have that information. They get that information when they get their lots, and that's the best thing we can do until you start saving your own. Yes, ML. Yes. In one generation, you can do an amazing amount. I have very little experience seed saving. This year was the first time I really did anything in a, you know, on a production level. As an example, I bought 4 pounds of arugula seed from Johnny's. I had called them and called Fedco and called Haimoan, and they had 250,000 seeds per pound, and Fedco was 300,000. I don't remember what Haimoan was, but they had the fewest seeds per pound, so I bought my arugula from them. I bought 4 pounds. I planted 3. I grew them. I picked them numerous times. You know, when I got done with them, the next planting was coming in. I let them go to seed. I came back a month and a half later, 2 weeks, 2 months later, pulled them out, went up in the barn, you know, shook them all, took it, you know, just stuck it in a cup and went out and planted it. Next to the 4th pound that I hadn't planted. So I had the same seed, and I had, you know, 4 months later, but the same basic seed. And that was a seed that I planted this fall that was 4 inches tall when the pigweed was 1 inch tall. And the seed that I had saved had, you know, very large, nice, thick leaves when the seed that I was straight from the seed company was, you know, about the quarter of the size, literally a quarter of the size. All the yellowing and purpling that was present only on the store-bought seed. There was zero on my seed. It was profound transformation in one generation, one growing season. You know, I planted the seed the first time I planted it was Mother's Day, Father's Day, sometime, you know, and then I planted it again in September. Harvested that generation's seed again in September. I don't see why that wouldn't work for everything. I don't see why that wouldn't work. You've got the issue of pollination and cross-pollination, so if you got your gourds and your winter squash, I wouldn't save my winter squash seed. Yeah, if you keep them separate, I think one generation can do a lot, and 2 or 3 generations is all we need. I think in 2 or 3 years, you could have a dramatic effect, and one year is enough to really, really dramatically improve it. It's a bit of a hassle, but not really that much. Identify your healthy plants, stick a stake next to them. When they start to, you know, produce fruit, pick that fruit, put it aside. You can add it to your schedule per week at, you know, half an hour. You know, if you've got a staff person who, you know, is anal and, you know, likes to be particular about things, you know, put them on that job, and you can really get a lot of benefit shortly. I think that's really the solution, you know, for us in the near term. And I think if we start to make noise and talk to our seed companies, which a lot of us have relationships with, and, you know, are just clear and, you know, straightforward, I am happy to pay a major premium for quality seed. I think it's totally worth the money. Heirlooms versus hybrids. Obviously it's the open pollinated varieties that are most easy to save seed from. There are some people out there doing good work breeding back varieties. I should really put Frank Morton up. Everybody in the country agrees Frank Morton's the best. And it's Wild Garden Seed is the name of his company, I believe. Wild Garden Seed. So I bought all my greens for this year from him. He's got a complete lettuce genetics, you know, 300 varieties of lettuce, you know, at $80 a pound or $60 a pound. Plant that out, see which ones you like, save them. He's got a complete Asian greens genetics, complete leek genetics, complete kale genetics. You can buy the mix from him that has a whole bunch of well-grown out, open-pollinated, you know, in a Landrace fashion, open-pollinated genetics, and save the ones you like, the ones that flourish in your environment. It shouldn't be that hard. Solstice Seeds. I keep hearing about her. I don't know her particularly. So what she's talking about here is, you know, a local project in Vermont, you know, having gardeners growing out seed and working with local farmers. I think seed, you know, libraries, there's the Hudson Valley Seed Library, there's the Scatter Seed Project, there's, you know, the, who are those guys out in Iowa? Seed Savers Exchange. There's, you know, there's networks out there. My personal opinion is that those, a lot of those people, while well-meaning, are doing a pretty poor job on nutrition. And that's that. I mean, we just need to be honest about it, and there's no judgment, because all of us people who are growing crops are doing a similarly bad job, right? We're all in the same boat together. But from the perspective of seeds, it's really important. And if you've got gardeners who can pay attention and give lots of love to those plants, go for it.
All right.
Talk to me afterwards. Yes, we need to make this happen. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anybody in Western Mass, you can talk to her. Anybody in Vermont, talk to her.
Yeah.
What's that? You guys want to raise your hands? You know who you look. You know who you are. What's that? You're in New Hampshire. I'm sorry. That's right. Yes. There's a role for this. I think this is important from a systemic perspective. If we want to grow high quality food, we must deal with this limiting factor. This is a limiting factor, and again, like I said before, all the minerals and all the biology, you know, are critical, certainly, and people accentuate, you know, we focus on those in these conversations and these courses. I think these are actually really crucial components to a complete functioning system. So I think I've made that point sufficiently. Inoculation. What are we at for time, Ben?
We're at 10:11.
How long do I have? Till 10:15?
Till 10:15 or a little bit later.
All right. So I'm going to do inoculation now, and then we will take a break. And Derek's going to come back, and we're going to talk about starting seeds, and we're going to walk through the growing season. Coming after the break. So inoculation, I think that was fairly well covered yesterday. Did anybody have any specific questions? I mean, basically, I don't have a sample here, but get your hands on ideally a broad spectrum inoculant. Literally, an ounce will do dozens of pounds of seed. You know, I generally tell people when I give them this course, if you're going to spend money on anything, from what I recommend, buy seed inoculant. It is the best spent money. No. Thank you.
It might be a question for later, but I was thinking about the GMO stuff and wondering if we should be coating our seeds in manganese and zinc.
A good seed inoculant will have a bunch of minerals on it too.
It will have both of those in it.
It'll have some humates, it'll have some limestone, it'll have some maybe a little bit of kelp on it. Yes. A good seed inoculant will not just have all those species. John, would you like to discuss this principle? A good comprehensive seed inoculant, what the ingredients would be, theoretically?
In first grade. Basically, in putting together a very comprehensive seed quality inoculant, I look for three things, as I mentioned yesterday. The first is that we need a comprehensive suite of soil biology, not just mycorrhizal fungi, not just bacteria, not just a trichoderma and another conventional fungi mix, but really a combination of all three. The second thing that I look for is I want really good comprehensive nutrition, as you were just mentioning, Julie. And to put that nutritional package together, I want that to contain a broad spectrum of trace minerals, and in addition, other biologically stimulating materials. So we might include materials such as seaweed, is a very good seed coating material, perhaps diatomaceous earth to enhance some of the soil biology, perhaps some humic substances, and then we can... It would be possible to include zinc and manganese as a seed coating, but typically we do zinc and manganese in the row in slightly larger quantities to counteract what is going on. So we do include that in the system as well.
Thank you. And is it possible that you could share with us a list of specific species to look for in a product? I mean, you can give it to me later if you want. We can email it out to people.
I don't really have I'm not good enough at remembering names to give you a list off the top of my head, but look for diversity. What I look for, and it takes me several hours of focusing on the biology and really studying biology and reacquainting myself with it because it's not an area that I focus a lot on, but I look for what I term as very strong foundational species. So there is this concept I mentioned me briefly yesterday afternoon, biological transmutation of elements. We know that it is a fact of life. It happens all the time. Another concept that is not well recognized here in America, but is very well recognized in Europe and Russia, is that of pleomorphism. And pleomorphism essentially states that for the core concept of pleomorphism is that we have, in the past, science has identified tens of thousands of different strains of microbial species. Today, we no longer believe that all of those different microbial species are necessarily independent of each other, but that we have perhaps one core group, such as the Pseudomonas family, for example. And that Pseudomonas family can transmute based on the environment in which it finds itself. So you put Pseudomonas into one variety, or one environment, and it might be, in today's standards, identified as Pseudomonas fluorescens. You put that same species into another environment, and you will develop, that strain will develop into what today is identified as a different species. But it isn't actually a different species, it's only that species propagating and developing in a different environment. So it's expressing itself differently. Environment determines genetic expression. And so what this really means is that perhaps instead of having tens of thousands of microbial strains, we may have only a few hundred base strains that are expressing themselves differently. So this is when in the products that we put together, we use a lot of the Tinio microbial inoculants because they recognize this concept of pleomorphism and they establish really strong, really energetic base species of bacterial groups in their microbial inoculants. Good. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you. In practice, I generally, when I get my seed, open the packet, put in a pinch, close the packet, shake it up, and don't worry about it anymore. There certainly is a good argument to be made for soaking your seed. John made a oblique comment to it yesterday. A little bit of seawater and a little bit of kelp in, call it maybe 5% of seawater and kelp, 95% water, and soaking your seed in that overnight to stimulate sprouting can be very beneficial. Generally, after doing that, you'd want to apply the inoculant. Or you can, what I like to do in field situations and big, more mechanized situations, if you've got a row that you're planting seed into or transplant holes, and you're going to be mixing, you're going to be putting some water in that row or that hole, putting the inoculants into the water that's going into the hole or the row will get the job done as well. Anything else, John? That's good. Okay. I don't know. How does diatomaceous earth enhance soil microbiology? I was thinking whey powder is oftentimes used.
Yes, whey powder is oftentimes used as well. Diatomaceous earth actually enhances soil biology not so much as by providing a food source. It's not a food source, but it provides a structure and a home for them to really establish and grow very quickly because of the open porous structure. On a microbial level, it's you can almost think of it as a sponge. It's a very open porous structure. So it provides a...
Like
for all intents and purposes,
biochar, zeolite.
Yes, it's an empty domain. There is no microbial population already established there, so it can become established very quickly and then grow from that core group.
It's an apartment block. Yeah. That would be worked into your inoculant. You would take your species of bacteria and fungi and mix them with diatomaceous earth or whey, kelp powder, things like that, and some nice minerals, a carbonatite or an azomite or something, a broad spectrum mineral that's got a bunch of traces in there, a little bit of kelp powder, a little bit of diatomaceous earth, a little bit of whey as buffer, because the actual species themselves are extraordinarily small, right? To get your 500 million Pseudomonas takes, a extremely small amount of space, and then you need something for filler, to mix it with, so you can spread it out over your seed, and those are the things you can use to mix as filler. Yes. What I generally do in all cases is when I buy my seed, I open the box, I open every bag, I take my inoculant, and I just do a pinch into each bag. I close each bag, shake them up, stick them back in the box, and put it in the freezer, and I'm done. And like I said, an ounce will do dozens of pounds of seed, 25, 50 pounds of seed, depending on the seed size. And it's very inexpensive. And it's functionally is providing that, colostrum, that it's establishing the digestive system of the plant. Anybody understands all the Sally Fallon heads out here? Anybody? Weston Pricers? Yes, you understand the role of gut, life, of lactofermentation, all that to get the gut health going. It's critical in the plant, it's critical in the cow, it's critical in the human. When you understand that principle and you can get that present, it's extraordinarily beneficial. Very inexpensive, very easy, very simple. A lot of these things, simple things done well have a dramatic effect. That's what I would like you guys to take from this morning session. Yep. If you're mixing your inoculant with your potting soil, the amount of your potting soil that is in contact with your seed means that when your plant actually germinates, it has contact with a very minor percent of the inoculant you used. A good potting soil made from a good compost has all that inoculant in it already.
We actually like to inoculate our seed and soak it. So we put it in the bag, and then we soak it later before we plant it, and just take it out. It'll still be there. I don't want to wash off.
So if you're going to be soaking your seed as well as inoculating it, and should you put the inoculant in before or after? My general understanding is that when you have biology in water, for more than 3 or 4 hours, they use up the oxygen and asphyxiate. They're aerobic. They can be functional anaerobes in some cases. So I think it would make much more sense if you know you're going to be soaking the seed before you plant it to add the inoculant after you soak. Anybody who knows better can disagree with me. Yes?
You say you, after you shake it up, you put it in the freezer?
Yes.
Why do you put it in the
freezer? Why do I put it in the freezer? Because that's what we did when I was a kid. No, I think there's something about, you know, keeping it cool, keeps it maintains its vigor longer. It doesn't lose its...
Hydrate and dehydrate.
I think you're basically, the idea is, I mean, what I always assumed was you have that plant, that seed, think it's wintertime. And when it comes out of the freezer, it thinks it's springtime, and then you get it wet and you plant it, and it's like, oh, okay, it's springtime. But I don't know. I think it's just general practice.
I've tried this year just putting mine in jars and sealing it in my vacuum sealer. And I've always kept mine in the fridge in plastic bags. I don't know if this year, but I'm going to try that.
Keeping it in a jar and with a vacuum sealer to take the hydration out. My understanding is that the electromagnetic fields that are... caused by freezers and machines are not good for keeping your seed in or being in the presence of or having your inoculants in the presence of. So definitely, I mean, that background EMF frequency, you know, pollution, radiation, I think is inherently not good on principle. So, but I don't know, I couldn't speak more intelligently on that. I keep mine in the freezer. Yeah. For a while, I kept it in a bucket in the barn. You know, I feel good about myself getting it into the freezer. Anybody else, or we're out of time here? Mm-hmm. My perspective on Tanio's inoculants, everybody who I respect thinks that Tanio's doing a good job, and I haven't researched it enough myself to know enough to speak intelligently. Tanio Technology and Technique is a company that sells biological inoculants, TANIO.com. Bruce Tanio, for those who had never heard of Bruce, is, I think, you know, like Tesla or somebody. Nobody's heard about him. Nobody's going to hear about him for the next 50 years. But when they do, they're going to realize who he was. Bruce recently passed. I had a chance to meet him a few times, and John actually got to work with him a good amount. But Bruce Tanio is one of those names. If you are interested in learning what some of the seminal thinkers have actually figured out, check him out and see if you can figure out what he was up to. Did he write a book? John can speak better about the Tanios, but Bruce was a really brilliant individual. And then we'll call it a break.
Yes, I fully agree with Dan's evaluation of Bruce, and in fact, I think it might be closer to 100 years before we really begin to realize the import of a lot of the work that Bruce did. But that as an aside, Bruce never, he took much of his information with him when he passed on, which is very unfortunate. However, his wife is attempting to capture a good deal of his information and put it into writing as much as possible. And that book is in progress. It has not been completed yet, but I expect that to be published before the end of this year, possibly by Acres or someone like that. So keep your eyes open for that. I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be incredible.
And when it comes to energizing water and things like that, Bruce put together a little tool called a polarity pillow, which is out of stock, and I think they're going to be making something new or similar. But it's one of those things, you know, spend $100 and just leave it next to your irrigation system. You know, just keep it in your pocket. You know, you don't really understand how it works. Doesn't really matter. It really works. Throw money around every once in a while, like, just on a whim, I'm going to try something I really want to do and don't ever get to do. I would recommend one of those. From Tanio. Tanio.com. Bruce did a bunch of really interesting things. I don't have time to talk about it. I don't really know everything, but really interesting fellow. Anybody studied Tesla or looked into Tesla? Yeah, like something like that. Like he was up to a bunch of really interesting things. So anyway, okay, it's 10:25. We'll call it 10:40. Come back.